Dr. Kevin Coates playing the mandolin and his wife Nell Romano playing the harpsichord in two movements by Dallabacco. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've found it interesting and thank you so much for listening. I'll be here during the week with Essential Classics. But next week, James is back with his own custom-built selection. I have my next Sunday appointment with you in about 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening. Just a quick reminder to get in touch with your suggestions for our Sunday supplement, and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. Studio production this morning was by Neil Miners.
In the run-up to Christmas, Radio 3 brings you a week of live concerts from the Temple Winter Festival. 5 world-class choirs singing seasonal music in the atmospheric Crusader Church nestled in the heart of London's Law Courts. 2 inspiring early music groups, Vox Luminous and Gallicantus, mine the riches of the Renaissance. Polyphony and the Temple's own church choir present a 20th century Christmas, and the week culminates on Friday at 7 o'clock with the BBC Singers and a performance of Handel's Messiah as you've never heard it before. Join me, Sarah Moore Peach, live at the Temple Winter Festival every evening this week, starting tomorrow at 7:30 and for 30 days online, BBC Radio 3. On air, online, on when you want.
At 2 o'clock this afternoon, you can hear the late Christopher Hogwood in conversation with Catherine Bott in today's edition of The Early Music Show. But now, with the time just after midday, more conversation. It's time for Private Passions. This week, Michael Barclay's guest is the historian Eamon Duffy.
We should not project modern sensibilities onto the people of the past. This has been a guiding principle of my guest this week, the Catholic historian Eamon Duffy. Professor of the History of Christianity at Cambridge, he has changed forever the way we view the Reformation. His books have revealed a picture of late medieval Catholicism as a strong and vital tradition, and shown that the Reformation, for most ordinary people, represented a violent disruption to a flourishing religious system. Eamon, you say we shouldn't project modern sensibilities onto the people of the past, but that must be quite difficult, even for a professional historian.
Well, it is. It's probably impossible, but there's a sense in which historians often set themselves up in judgment on the people of the past, and I think it's tremendously important to grasp that value systems change. We live one side of the Enlightenment. The people I study lived the other side. It hadn't happened for them. And all sorts of things that we take as axiomatic simply weren't on their horizon. That's led me to tackle some controversial topics like, for example, the burning of Protestants, nearly 300 of them, by Queen Mary in the mid-16th century, something that's rightly horrified all modern historians, but which I think the horror distorted perceptions of the effectiveness of persecution. Somebody somewhere has said persecution almost always works. And it's very difficult for a modern historian to work with that as an assumption and to take a cool look at what the effect of this was on contemporaries. So in that sense, one has to try and disinfect one's own moral perceptions. And that can be difficult and painful exercise.
Your landmark book, The Stripping of the Altars, Traditional Religion in England, 1400 to 1580, revealed what traditional religion meant to ordinary people. Do you think that growing up in the Irish Catholic tradition helped you with this?
I'm sure it did. I was brought up in Ireland in the 1950s, and the religion that I was immersed in and that most of my contemporaries were immersed in had huge continuities with the religion of the Middle Ages. It was still very much not only a religion of church and sacrament, but of holy wells and local saints. And I think that was a resource to me in looking at the past. For a start, unlike most historians of the Reformation, in looking at pre-Reformation religion, I wasn't horrified. There was a sort of familiarity about it that meant one could see its overall shape rather than just notice, if you like, the oddities.
You've written widely about Catholicism, including a history of the papacy, but I notice you keep returning to the late medieval and Tudor periods. And in fact, your first piece takes us nicely there. It's also a living part of the liturgy, isn't it?
Yes, Byrd's Ave Verum, one of seven or eight pieces he wrote, probably for the Feast of Corpus Christi. I imagine it was first performed in a Catholic country house, perhaps in Essex. We know of a Corpus Christi procession in the grounds of one of the houses that Byrd visited in Essex in 1605, something watched by Protestant spies, and that's how we know about it. So we have to imagine this music being performed with some sense of urgency and danger, and that's very remarkable because it's such a magnificently tranquil meditation on the mystery of Christ's presence.
Thank you.
One of the things I love about that piece is the perfect match between the words and the music. It was a big issue in the Reformation that the music of the Catholic past had subordinated word to sound, but Bird there manages to take medieval devotional text and give it perfect expression.
And I love the use of space too, which is one of the ways he does that, but of course it's perfectly suited for large cathedrals where the sound can die away before the next phrase begins.
Yes, all the more interesting, therefore, that he probably wrote it for quite small rooms in private houses.
William Byrd's an extraordinary figure from Tudor England, isn't he? And a Catholic composer who nonetheless found enduring favour with the Protestant Elizabeth I.
Yes, it's part of the cultural dilemma of the Reformation that, in theory, Protestantism was hostile to the visual arts, hostile to elaborate music, and yet people went on wanting beautiful music. Queen Elizabeth herself was something of a ritualist. One can see Byrd's accommodation with the Protestant establishment becoming less and less comfortable as time goes on. He starts life as organist at Lincoln Cathedral, then he's gentleman of the Chapel Royal. But by the 1580s, the Queen is executing large numbers of priests, and Catholics like him, who have operated within the establishment, are having to make hard choices.
William Byrd's Ave Verum, performed by Harry Christophers and the 16. Before you worked on the Tudor period, Eamon, you were a scholar of the 17th and 18th centuries, which I imagine might be when you developed a passion for our next composer, Purcell, Henry Purcell.
Yes, indeed. I began life as an 18th century historian and then moved back into the 17th century, and Purcell seems to me, after Byrd, the greatest English composer. And since 1979, I've been a fellow at Magdalen College, Cambridge, and Pepys was a Magdalen man and a great lover of music. And the Pepys librarian for most of my time at Magdalen, Richard Luckett, is one of the leading authorities on the music of Purcell's period. So I received a sort of second education from him on these matters.
And we're going to hear a countertenor who, in a way, started a whole movement in this country for countertenors. Yes. Alfred Deller, a wonderful voice he had.
Who was discovered by Michael Tippett, singing in, I think, Salisbury Cathedral Choir as a male alto. And Tippett realised that this was a countertenor voice, and both he and Benjamin Britten wrote marvellous music for Deller. I was lucky enough to attend Deller's last concert. I think it was his last concert. My first teaching job was in London, King's College London. And in the summer of 1979, I went to hear Deller at St. Bartholomew the Great, and he sang the one we're going to hear now, Music for a While. The voice really was long past its best by then, but it was an absolutely entrancing experience. The sheer mastery of the music is magnificent. Phrasing and expression. He died 3 weeks later.
Wonderful the way Purcell sets this, and especially the opening, which I always find utterly enticing.
It's got lots of resonances for me. In 2001, I was visiting a professor in Rome and away from my family for a long time, and hugely enjoying Rome, but some of the evenings were long. And most evenings, I ended the evening with a drink and this music, and its melancholy and beauty were hugely comforting.
Music for
It's incredibly sensuous and evocative, isn't it? Alfred Deller in Purcell's Music for a While, with William Christie playing the harpsichord and Wieland Kuijken the bass viol. When you hear that again, I notice a smile of great pleasure on your countenance.
It's wonderful, and the whole album in which it occurs is full of the most enchanting music, the evening hymn. It's one of my most treasured possessions.
Your books, Eamon Duffy, are particularly fascinating because they allow us to hear the voices of ordinary and sometimes illiterate people who are often otherwise written out of history. I think it's especially true of the Voices of Morbath, which chronicled lives of the priest and people of remote and poor Exmoor Parish during the religious upheavals of the Tudor period. A very moving book which reads almost like a novel. And I imagine it must have been a deeply emotional experience to write.
Yes, once in a lifetime, if you're lucky as a historian, you come across a source that really does open a new kind of window. And the priest of Morbath, Sir Christopher Trickey, for 54 years kept a detailed record of transactions in the parish. Other historians had looked at it, been used by Hoskins' famous book on Devon, but most people had used a transcription of it, and the transcription got wrong the crucial fact at the heart of the book. A mistranscription of a place name concealed the fact that this parish had joined the rebellion against the prayer book in 1549, that they had, in effect, rejected the Reformation. And when I discovered the mistranscription, I realised there was an amazing story, because it's the only parish which actually documented the arming and equipping of rebels against the crown. As I worked through the text, I really did begin to hear the voice of this long-dead priest. To my huge delight, the Dictionary of National Biography have asked me to write a short biography of him for inclusion in the next edition. So I feel I have acted as a sort of resurrection man.
What was the role of music in the lives of the Tudor parishioners of Morbath?
Morbath's a tiny place, 33 households, so about 150 people. And for high days and holy days, the priest records the occasional payment of singers and of extra clergy. So they would have a high mass with plain song. They might even have had somebody with a small portable organ. So we know far too little about music in the parish church, both before and immediately after the Reformation. And I think one of the exciting developments in the history of religion in the 15th, 16th century is more people are taking interest in that. And we're now getting a sense that the cultural landscape in 15th century England was a good deal richer than you might think.
This next piece caused you some agony in the choosing, did it not?
Handel steals them all. I had to have Handel. Handel is one of my favourite composers, and I was very exercised about what to have. At one stage, I was involved in playing a lot of Baroque chamber music myself with small amateur groups, and Handel wrote, of course, a great deal.
You'd play the recorder?
Yes, a variety of recorders. My wife was an oboist when she was younger, and one of the things we did when we were a young married couple was meet up with other young married couples who played instruments and made music in that way. In the end, I thought that it has to be vocal music, and I didn't want to go for something obvious like Messiah or one of the more sensational arias from one of the operas. And this marvellous piece of music, in a way, I've encountered through its place in his setting of Milton's L'Allegro il Penseroso, the cheerful man and the glum man, and his librettist, Charles Jennings, in a characteristic 18th century way, composed a third moderating part called Il Moderato, and this comes from that. It's a marvellous piece of music.
As steals the morn upon the night and melts the shades away, so truth does fancy's charm dissolve, and rising reason puts to flight the fumes that did the mind involve, restoring intellectual day.
Thank you.
Mark Padmore and Lucy Crowe singing wonderfully As Steals the Morn Upon the Night, from the third part of Handel's L'Allegro, il Penseroso ed il Moderato, setting words by Charles Jennens. Andrew Manzi was conducting the English concert. Interesting lyric, Eamon. Almost a motto for a historian restoring intellectual day.
Yes, intellectual is so characteristic of its period. I think it was written about 1740, and it's the height of the English Enlightenment. One's reminded of one of those disciples of Voltaire who was asked if he'd ever laughed and said, "I have never made the ha-ha." There's no extremes, everything light, no shadows.
Haydn next, Eamon Duffy, and chamber music. I'm not surprised from what you've said so far that chamber music is something that appeals to you both as a player and as a listener.
Haydn's come to mean more and more to me as I've got older, and especially the string quartets and the piano trios. Such civilized music, full of life affirmation, full of wit, full of balance. And I don't think there's any experience like making music in a small group. Your dependence on other people.
The fact you have to listen.
Absolutely. I suppose, like being in a small choir, it's the best way of getting inside a piece of music, really hearing it. And again, I had difficulty choosing what I would include, but in the end I opted for one of the marvellous piano trios. This one's from the early 1790s, Haydn at the height of his reputation, writing music deliberately designed to please a general public, and it in a mode that was intended really for bourgeois people to make music in their own homes.
It's so successful, particularly this piece, and I think one realises that if Mozart had not been contemporaneous, we would actually worship Haydn even more than we do, although a lot of us now, I think, have come to realise what a great composer he is.
Yes, and of course, Haydn had the misfortune not to die young.
So he wasn't a tragic kind of icon.
You couldn't write Amadeus about the life of Haydn, though it had its sadnesses, miserable marriage. And in some ways, he's a more conventional man. You know, this is a man who, when he ran out of musical ideas, was inclined to say the rosary. So he doesn't fit the picture of artist in rebellion or the artist with the world against him. He actually was rather a shrewd businessman. He had a successful, though modest, life.
He wasn't a James Dean, a rebel without a cause.
Absolutely not. And yet, the marvellous, marvellous torrents of music that pour out.
And what's wonderful about this piece is the performance, I think. The Beaux-Arts Trio have always been one of my favourite groups. And I think when you listen to this music and the playing, you get a perfect marriage.
Absolutely. What we were talking about earlier about making chamber music, here it is in perfection. Thank you.
We heard the Beaux-Arts Trio, Menahem Pressler playing the piano, Isidore Cohen the violin, and Bernard Greenhouse the cello in the third movement of Haydn's Piano Trio number 32 in A. And by the way, you can find details of all Eamon Duffy's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. As you said, you did play chamber music with your wife, her oboe to your recorder, and the next piece is also something which has close connections to her.
Yes, the singer is Janet Baker, and I first encountered Janet Baker on a LP that my wife, then my girlfriend, owned of English folk songs, and was absolutely bowled over by the voice. And I don't think there is a better interpreter of Elgar, her marvellous role as the angel in the great Barbarolli recording of The Dream of Gerontius. But I decided not to choose something from Elgar's religious music.
How do you feel about that piece, actually? I'm very interested.
The Dream? Mm. I think it's an astonishing piece of music. He famously said, "This is the best of me," and streets ahead of any of his other major attempts at religious writing. I mean, I think The Apostle is an unspeakably dreary piece of music. But I opted instead for music written just before The Dream, the Sea Pictures, the texts not so distinguished as Newman's for the most part. The one I've chosen, The Lands Where Coral Lie, by the late 19th century poet Richard Garnett. But it's the wonderful energy and pace of the music and the voice of Janet Baker that make it, I think, unforgettable.
Leave me, leave me, let me
Janet Baker, memorably singing Edward Elgar's setting of Richard Garnett's Where Corals Lie, the fourth of Elgar's sea pictures. And we heard John Barbirolli conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Eamon, how do you feel about the current state of music in the Western Catholic liturgy?
That's rather a depressing question. There are marvellous composers who have made real attempts to write music that can be performed by parish congregations. James Macmillan is one who comes to mind. But certainly in England and I think in America, there's been a tendency for the liturgy to have become associated with a particular moment in folk music. And so we sing in church the kind of music that we would never dream of listening to and that we only otherwise hear at school assemblies. And I think there's been a radical impoverishment and a loss of the sense of the numinous. We've developed a very strong horizontal dimension to worship. Everybody shakes everybody's hand, and I approve of that in many ways. But the traditional function of music to lift the spirits and to provide a standard of excellence that transcends the everyday, I think is much harder to recover.
Because there is a danger that in thinking that one appeals to everyone by looking for the lowest common denominator, that you do quite the opposite of transcending. And after all, I think mere mortals need everything going in order to reach that state that one would like to be in a church.
The theory behind it often included the idea that everybody ought to participate, and so you got church orchestras together in which people played recorders and triangles and guitars and so on. And that it was better that there should be participatory music than that there should be excellent music. This is not a new phenomenon. It's in Thomas Hardy's Under the Greenwood Tree, you know, when the high church vicar tries to introduce a surpliced choir and an organ, and that gets rid of the old orchestra with the serpent and tuba and the fiddle. So that theme of the replacement of community-based mediocre music and, if you like, low-class music by something more elite, it's a perpetual problem.
Jazz, Eamon, I don't think you're madly passionate about jazz.
No, I suppose my musical tastes have become rather stuffily formal, but I have a son who is extraordinarily knowledgeable about jazz and mildly evangelical about it, and he has made a number of attempts at educating me, of which the most successful was introducing me to Duke Ellington's band, and in particular to the playing of Johnny Hodges, most marvellous saxophonist. A man with really a rather catastrophic life, drug addict, drunk, womanizer. Like a lot of Ellington's musicians, really the life a disaster, but the music sublime. And this particular piece, in a way it links up with Baroque music, because what's essential about it is that the interpretation is entirely the player's. There are recordings of Isfahan, played by Johnny Hodges, all over YouTube. They're all different. And on the Far East Suite, which is the album from which this is taken, there are in fact two takes, again, quite different in feel. The tune, I think, is by Billy Strayhorn, who was the main composer for Ellington's band. But Hodges inhabits this music in the most marvellous way.
I was going to say it must be quite a nice counterpoint for you to immerse yourself in the work of a drunken, womanising genius, given that you spend so much time in sacred waters, except that, of course, if one goes back in history, there was quite a lot of drunkenness and womanising even amongst the clergy.
There are some queer fish in sacred waters.
Thank you.
Wonderful, seductive sound. You can see he might have been a successful womanizer.
Absolutely, it's voluptuous music, isn't it?
Johnny Hodges playing Isfahan from the Duke Ellington album, The Far East Suite. Eamon Duffy, as we said at the beginning, your Catholic faith has been very much the heart of your work as a historian. And do you find that that faith has enriched your work, if you like?
Well, there are two views about that. Some people think that it may have distorted it, in that one tends to look at the world through a particular set of spectacles. My own view is that everybody looks at the world through a particular set of spectacles, and so long as you're clear about what they are and do your best to be honest, on the whole, one's intuitions and experience are an asset rather than a drawback. I don't subscribe to the myth of the neutral observer. There is no such thing.
No, because to develop a passion in a subject means that you usually come from it from some kind of not disinterested view.
Sure, there are advantages of that and prices to be paid for it. And the main thing is to be aware that if you come from a particular perspective, that may alert you to things that other people miss, but equally it may blind you to things that other people see. And that's why academic life is a perpetual conversation with other people looking at the same material from a different point of view.
Tell me about this last piece, which is sung by a Catholic nun and from a very particular tradition.
Marie Carouse, Sister Marie Carouse, is a Melkite nun. She's Lebanese, born in the 60s. And she's the premier liturgical singer among Eastern Rite Catholics, and indeed among Orthodox liturgical singers from the Middle East. I wanted this piece for a number of reasons. In 2001, I taught at the Gregorian University in Rome. One of the students there was an Iraqi priest, Rahid Ghani, a delightful young man, whom I didn't know well but had a number of meals with. He was from Mosul. He went back to Mosul, where he became a parish priest. In 2007, Islamic extremists ordered him to abandon his parish and leave Mosul. He refused to do it. And a few Sundays later, they confronted him and three of his assistant clergy, married subdeacons, demanded that they convert to Islam, and when they refused, gunned them down. Rahid is now venerated as a martyr. But knowing him alerted me to the presence in the Arab-speaking world of very large numbers of Arab Christians who've really been under immense pressure for the last 30 years, and for whom by and large, the Arab Spring has been a disaster. These Christian communities, they are among the oldest Christian communities in the world. You can trace their origins right back to the 4th and some of them to the 3rd century. Many of them use Arabic in the liturgy. But one of the problems about the rise of militant Islamism is that being Arabic and being Muslim are being equated. And this is a tragedy for the Arab world as well as for the Christians there, because it narrows the identity and the self-understanding of what it is to be an Arab. The piece of music I've chosen is a text from the liturgy of the Melkite liturgy of Palm Sunday. It's sung in Arabic, and it opens with an invocation of God by the name Allah. As you probably know, the Malaysian government have recently outlawed the use of the name Allah by Christians. So I wanted to allow the voice of these people to be heard. Our own government and the governments of the West in general are very chary about supporting them because they don't want to appear to be conducting some kind of crusade or espousing the cause of Christianity against Islam, and that's all very understandable. But these ancient communities are now being decimated, and we're losing a link with the very earliest days of Christianity in what were its ancient heartlands. So this is a very important piece of music to me. That's a remarkable voice, and I don't think if one came to it cold, one would guess that it's a Christian liturgical text and a Christian prayer.
Well, there's a marvellous meeting of East and Western music there, isn't there? An Arab liturgical chant for Palm Sunday, Al-Arabu Dar-Alana, from Sister Marie Carouse. Do you think, finally, Eamon Duffy, and we could go on for hours on this, that you're to be envied for having faith? Is it more difficult to be genuinely without faith?
I hope not to be envied. I believe myself to be fortunate, or perhaps better, blessed in having faith. It's not always easy to keep it. The world can be a very grim place, and although I happen to live in a comfortable part of it, if one has eyes in one's head and a heart, one feels the pain of the world. But in a sense, I think religion is born out of a perception of the pain of the world, of the brokenness and its need of mending, and of the riddle in which we live. And I suppose the difference between someone who believes and someone who doesn't believe is that the believer hopes that the riddle has an answer.
There is one wonderful thing that joins those two disparate worlds of the believer and the non-believer, and that is the power of music.
Absolutely. When I taught at King's College London, the Dean of King's College London was a marvellous German Jew convert to Christianity who insisted that the one indubitable proof of the existence of God was music.
Eamon Duffy, thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure.
Michael Barclay's guest was the historian Eamon Duffy. The producer was Jane Greenwood for Loftus. And it would, if you'd like to download that programme or others in the series, you can go to the podcast page of the Radio 3 website and find it there. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest will be the fashion designer Dame Vivian Westwood.
Make a lunch date with rising stars of the piano. From Tuesday to Friday, Radio 3's lunchtime concerts come from LSO St Luke's in London, where you can hear music from four of the world's best pianists, all under 30. Lise de la Salle, Dienis Kuzhukhin, Federico Colli and Alice Sara Ott have been making waves and winning competitions from Salzburg to Leeds. They'll be playing masterworks of the piano repertoire from the glittering virtuosity of Ravel to the brooding drama of Beethoven. Join me, Verity Sharp, for lunchtime concerts from 1 o'clock on Tuesday and for the rest of the week. And don't forget that you can listen again to every concert for 30 days via the Radio 3 website.
Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes this afternoon on Radio 3. And indeed, we have a lunchtime concert next this afternoon, a second chance to hear the live one we brought to you from Wigmore Hall in London last week. It was given by the countertenor Philippe Jaruski and the group that he founded over a decade ago now, Arta Cersei. It's an all Vivaldi programme, and the early music theme will then continue after that when this week's edition of the Early Music Show features a recording of an interview given to Radio 3 by Christopher Hogwood, who died in September this year. The early music show, well worth a listen, is at 2. But before all of that, a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. The group of MPs who are investigating allegations of British involvement in torture is to ask the American government to hand over secret parts of a damning report published last week on the interrogation techniques used by the CIA in the wake of the September the 11th attacks. The chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, Malcolm Rifkin, says he will make an official request for access to redacted passages that relate to the UK. The new leader of Scottish Labour, Jim Murphy, has said that he won't be consulting Ed Miliband on policies or campaigns in Scotland. Mr. Murphy insisted that what happens in Scotland will be decided in Scotland. His predecessor, Johan Lamont, resigned after the independence referendum, saying Labour's Westminster leadership had treated the party in Scotland as a branch office. Reports from Japan say the ruling coalition has won an overwhelming victory in the country's parliamentary elections. The Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, called the election 2 years early to win a fresh mandate for his efforts to revitalise the economy. Japan has slipped back into recession despite massive government spending. Environmentalists have criticised a compromise agreement to reduce global warming reached after days of deadlock at the UN climate talks in Peru, claiming that it doesn't go far enough. Delegates have approved a framework for setting national pledges, but many of the key decisions have been put off until next year. The Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has said a Labour government would introduce new checks on migrants designed to stop foreign criminals from becoming UK citizens. Under the plans, foreign nationals applying for British citizenship will be required to produce evidence of any criminal record. Last week, the Chief Borders Inspector, John Vine, sharply criticised the quality of Home Office checks. Three official photographs have been released of Prince George. The toddler is sitting in the courtyard of Kensington Palace wearing shorts and a knitted tank top. And the weather this afternoon, it'll be dry and bright in the southeast, cloudier though elsewhere, with occasional rain in the west. And that's the BBC News and the weather. The time is 3 minutes past one. And now, as I say, another chance to hear last Monday's live lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall in London. It was introduced by Sarah Moore Peach.
Welcome to a packed Wigmore Hall on this winter's lunchtime. Everyone here has come to hear the celebrated young countertenor Philippe Jaruski with his own baroque band that he founded 12 years ago, Ensemble Arta Cersei. Jaruski is known for his vocal fireworks and the incredible delicacy of his tone. Applause is for the band Ensemble Arta Cersei, which Jaruski formed with Claire Antonini, the theorbo player today, and Gioco Nakamura, harpsichordist. Their new project is called Pietà, Sacred Works and Concertos by Vivaldi. Today they're performing Vivaldi's Stabat Mater and motet Longe Mala Umbre Terrore. And before each vocal work, The ensemble plays a short concerto for strings, the first of those in C minor, dating from 1727.